Were Florida's pill mills the gas on the fire of the opioid crisis? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this Monday morning, new data is out on the true scale of the opiate epidemic. What are your thoughts and questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a First Coast success story. All of that and more just ahead. But first this morning, new data shows the true extent of the nation's opioid crisis and how Florida played a major role. In just 7 years, billions of hydrocodone and oxycodone pills flooded into Florida. From 2006 to 2012, they poured across the state through shady clinics we all now know as pill mills. Hundreds of millions more of these meds came through grocery stores and chain pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens. This, according to new data provided by the Drug Enforcement Agency and published in the Washington Post. Now, while the figures may be new, the takeaway is not. Florida's loose regulations on pain clinics lured addicts across state lines and helped fuel the national crisis. We're beginning the hour with a closer look as we welcome Dr. Raymond Palm, addiction specialist at Gateway Community Services in River Region. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Dr. Christine Caulfield, also a specialist and CEO of LSF Health Systems.
Good morning.
And Doug Jones, executive director of Jacksonville's Alco House. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And your calls. What are your thoughts about the new data looking at the true horror of the opioid epidemic? We'll also take a look at what's being done here in North Florida to treat people who are suffering. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Let's begin with you, Dr. Caulfield. This data is pretty incredible to look at. For example, here in Duval County alone, we learned from the Drug Enforcement Administration last week that in Duval County alone, there were 300 million prescription pain pills, enough for 50 pills per person per year, supplied to Duval County, Florida. That's an astounding amount of medication.
It really is. It's shocking. It's a situation that has many tentacles and many reasons why this happened in our great state. And I know Dr. Palm was very involved with a medical examiner's group, and he's going to share more about that. But you know, the good news is we now have a registry so that we can track folks that are trying to doctor shop, if you will. But that was a long time coming.
Right. Dr. Palm, Florida belatedly got around to cracking down on pill mills and the loose distribution of opioids, which has caused so much incredible harm and pain in this country. At the same time, we're learning that Walgreens, CVS, Activist Pharma, and the Paxson Prescription Center in Jacksonville, they receive the highest number of pills, according to the DEA database. As you and other addiction specialists are trying to deal with the fallout from this, can you bring us up to date on what's being done here locally to help addicts? You are spearheading a pilot program in the city of Jacksonville in conjunction with the city to work on this problem.
Yes, actually, the pilot program began in November 2017. The pilot ended 6 months later and is now expanding. We're now in five emergency departments and expanding beyond that. We've seen probably somewhere between 300 and 400 individuals in the emergency departments have effectively intervened at some level, either traditional treatment and or just peer services. And these individuals coming in now have also been expanded from those that have just overdosed to those that have suffered in generally with substance use problems. Since we have been involved in this program since November 2017, we have only had 3 opioid-related deaths.
So overdose deaths are going down. That's the good news.
Yes? Where we are. In those emergency departments, the overdose deaths have gone down considerably. We have also achieved a 71% reduction in recidivism, meaning people don't come back anymore into the emergency departments because of ODs.
That's good to hear. And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937. Doug Jones, you are executive director of Alco House, located in Springfield, where people come to you to get clean. It used to be people came to a facility like yours to dry out from alcohol. These days, you're saying much more common that they're trying to dry out or clean up from opioids. Is that right?
That's right. It is much more common that people are coming in to see us and ask for help from us who are addicted to opioids, whether they're in the pill form or whether they're all the way into the heroin form. We're taking people in from the Project Save Lives program at Gateway that we're very thankful for. But people right off the street that are strung out on these pills, people that are coming from broken families, mothers whose children are in DCF care and trying to get clean. It's a tragedy, particularly when you're at the street level and seeing what this epidemic is doing to the citizens of Jacksonville.
It's truly tragic. And as we learn from this DEA data, people are initially begin taking these meds most often to deal with some kind of pain. Then they get so addicted that they go to the street level of the drug, which is heroin and fentanyl.
That's right. You know, the junkie, so to speak, is not, they don't start out with a needle in their arm under a bridge. It starts out, we were discussing this earlier before the show, they start out with the high school football player who pulled his knee. They start out with the housewife who hurt her back picking up her baby. They start out with kids who think it's okay just to smoke some marijuana, and then the marijuana doesn't do it for them anymore, and then they move on to something harder, and then that stops doing it for them, and then they move on to something harder, and they finally end up with that needle in their arm under a bridge, if they're lucky, and they didn't OD and die somewhere.
Right. And Dr. Caulfield, let's give all the credit to the Alco House, LSF Health Systems, Gateway, River Region. You all represent facilities that are frantically working to help people and address this crisis. Are you seeing, as Dr. Palm says, any positive signs in the last few years as people have gotten so aware of how severe this is?
You know, we have. The great news is that we're finding that peer specialists, those individuals with lived experience, those individuals that have struggled and have overcome and are in recovery now with their own former drug addiction, are the linchpin for helping those that are in the throes of this epidemic. They really are the catalyst for helping individuals think about recovery, get into recovery, and so we're very grateful for that aspect. We're also at LSF Health Systems working with a grant from Florida Blue, and we are going into primary care physicians' offices, dealing with the primary care physicians and their nursing staff, training them on a brief screening that they can administer when their patients come in to try to address addiction early, to try to get individuals that are just beginning on their addiction issues to get into recovery sooner. So mm-hmm. prevention, early intervention. So
that's the
helping
key
in that aspect.
Okay. And Dr. Palm, at the same time, the city of Jacksonville, like a lot of other states and municipalities around the country, is taking on the pharmaceutical companies. They have sued over this crisis and the incredible financial and human toll it's taken in our community. That is ongoing.
Yes, absolutely. I think cities around the country, hundreds and hundreds of cities around the country, are now joining the bandwagon, very reminiscent of the tobacco days.
Right. And what are your hopes for this litigation?
Well, my hopes are that lessons are to be learned and some money to be recouped in terms of what everyone's put in to try and solve this problem. And with a little bit more money, maybe we can actually make greater strides in solving the problem. More importantly, though, it's the lessons to be learned. And I get a little dismayed about our how we work in this country in terms of what lessons are really learned. We went through this with the tobacco you'd think that other companies would look at tobacco and have learned those lessons, but they turned right around and did the same thing again, irrespective of the cost of human lives.
Yeah. Doug Jones, the pharmaceutical giants certainly bear responsibility, but the medical profession does too in some respects, doesn't it? Even though their intentions were good, in the 1990s, doctors started classifying pain as the fifth vital sign. And they started prescribing opioids more aggressively to help people manage their pain. They didn't realize at the time that it would lead to this hideous situation of addiction and overdoses.
That's right. You know, I can only speak on my experience with that. I had a hip replacement surgery several years ago, and the doctors prescribed oxycodone for the pain through my physical rehabilitation. Because of a strong network that I already had in recovery, and by networking out to other doctors, I found that taking those oxycodones wasn't necessary, that I could get through my pain with ibuprofen. In recovery, it's a matter of how badly do you want to stay clean? How badly do you want to stay sober? Are you willing to withstand the pain and get on the other side of it without having to get addicted to these painkillers? Or are you going to take the easier, softer way? Mm-hmm. So it really, and thank God that Jacksonville is a community in America that has a tremendously strong 12-step community, mm-hmm. That people can find help with other addicts and other alcoholics to stay sober and to stay clean, you know, without having to go down that road any further than they already have.
And the three of you are certainly a part of that, doing amazing work in this community. And the need is still so great. And lots of calls as we talk about the new data sets that the DEA released last week, giving us a better look at the true scope of the opioid epidemic, including here in Florida. It's 549-2937. Curtis is on the north side. Hi, Curtis. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. I agree with everything that's been said so far. I just want to add this. I was just like the gentleman just spoke. I had knee surgery. But by me being informed, by listening to your show and NPR News 24/7, I was informed. So when I needed
all right. That's what we want to hear.
I told my doctor, no, I didn't want that. Give me something else. Give me an alternative. So one, people got to be informed. Then number two is, we got to address the real issue. The real issue is the government and our politicians who write these bills that allow these pharmaceutical companies to push out their medicine, and then the doctors who are given incentives to push their medicine out on people at any cost and regardless of the effect it has on the citizens. That's my comment.
Yeah, Curtis, thank you, and I'm glad to hear you opted for a more conservative course of pain relief. That's good news. Dr. Caulfield, you know, major politicians around this state are still taking campaign contributions from the pharmaceutical interests. What about his comments about who really is still not being fully held accountable for all of this?
You know, that's a very good question. And I just want to share with the audience that if you all like to read, there is a tremendous book out called Dreamland, and it really talks about how this whole epidemic came into being, if you will. Certainly there is much responsibility for the pharmaceutical companies. They prescribe these oxycodones, and frankly, oxycodone is a drug. All opioids are to be used for acute pain, not chronic pain. Yet they really pushed their salespeople, if you will, to tell the doctors that this drug is not addictive, mm-hmm. that there are no side effects, and you really need to focus on the patient's pain. So there's lots of responsibility to go around.
Albert is a pharmacist on the north side. Hey, Albert, thanks for calling.
Hey,
tell us
morning.
About your perspective on this.
Good boy. And again, just echoing with what you guys have been talking about, I from a pharmaceutical standpoint, actually being in the pharmacy, working at a major chain, and then opening my own pharmacy and doing it for over a decade now, I saw the trend, how it trended up, and now they're trying to kind of scale it back. put some regulations on it. But the part that no one's really talking about, because in the whole scope of things, there's multiple sections or multiple areas to blame. One, of course, being Big Pharma, which we're always talking about. Two, being the prescribers, of course. Three, the pharmacies, a lot of times. Four, the patients. But the quiet as it's kept from a independent pharmacy standpoint, it's the insurance companies. Because too often I have times when people are starting to get addicted, you recognize it, you reach out to the doctor and you say, hey, let's try to get this person on some Suboxone or some buprenorphine, something that could curb their appetite before they go down that slippery slope. Mm-hmm. But the insurances refuse to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So I've noticed that as an issue of being a pharmacist. But again, to echo what everyone's been talking about, there's nothing therapeutic outside of just blocking the pain that's in your mind, the pain receptors. So ibuprofen, meloxicam, gabapentin, other drugs are actually have a therapeutic effect as opposed to just blocking it, blocking the pain receptors in your mind. But I do believe that the insurance companies should also be looked at or investigated because of some of the things that they're doing. And then just from a business model, stepping away, because we are here to take care of people. However, these insurance companies' reimbursements are so bad. Doctors, independent pharmacies, even big pharmaceutical chains can barely keep their doors open because the margins are so bad for other drugs. It's almost like you're forced to sell drugs that people pay cash for. I mean, you're literally losing money every prescription unless it's a cash-paying patient. And unfortunately, most of your cash-paying patients are your opioid patients. And I mean, me personally, being a pharmacy owner, it's making me sick because it's almost like you have to do certain things that you don't want to do. Like you try to give the best care. And
do you feel like you're contributing in some sense then to this problem?
And that's the thing. It's like nobody's clean in the game, and it's almost like I'm really stressing natural supplements now, because the pharma, big pharma is involved, and so are the insurance company. I mean, nobody's clean in this game at all.
Okay.
I mean, they can't. They need to act like they are.
I hear you, Albert. That's Albert. He's a pharmacist on the North Side, and Dr. Palm. What about his comments, particularly what he's saying about the insurance companies?
Yes, I want to applaud both Albert and Curtis in what they're saying. I hope more and more people become informed where they can see the bigger picture. Yes, insurance companies, big pharma, our legislators, they're all have equal blame in this. I really don't see the difference between them, and I'm going to just say it, than the black market. Okay, mm-hmm. The motivation and the outcome are the same, greed and or power. Despite any outcome that might evolve out of this, which is people dying, doesn't matter. We want the money, we want the power, and it doesn't matter. There's very great similarity.
I mean, Doug, I remember a couple of years ago we interviewed the former medical examiner for Duval County, and she told us that at the morgue, the Duval County morgue downtown, they literally could not keep pace with the number of bodies that were streaming into the morgue. Deaths by overdose from heroin and fentanyl.
That's right. It seemed just a couple of years ago that there was, every time we turned around, there was somebody else overdosing and another funeral that we were going to. It seemed every week there were a handful of people that we knew through Alco House particularly that were dying.
And it honestly, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but it seemed to me that until a lot of really famous celebrities started dying of their addiction to this substance, that it didn't really penetrate at a deep level. When Prince died, when Tom Petty died, when another actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman, died, when celebrities started dying and it was revealed that they were struggling with this same addiction and that they had started down this path of taking pills for pain and that it had gotten out of their control. It struck me as so sad that famous people had to be affected by this for people to really understand how bad it is in this country.
People that are using these drugs, they know what the end game is. Dr. Palm mentioned tobacco and the problems a few years ago. tobacco companies would not be making money if people weren't smoking. Pharmaceutical companies aren't going to make money if these kids aren't taking these pills. The addicts, they know what the end result is if they continue going down that path. I feel like we need to address addiction, the problem of addiction, to educate and inform people what happens to you when you become a drug addict.
Yeah.
And what happens to you is your life is destroyed. And if you're lucky, you die. If you're not lucky, you spend 30 or 40 years as a drug addict, which is a fate worse than death.
And you've seen it up close. All of you have. And I know the pain that you, and the suffering that you're trying to deal with. I can feel it in your voice. And I really do appreciate all of you coming in here to talk about this, because it just is still a public health crisis in this community. Michael is downtown. He's been holding. Hi, Michael. Good morning.
Hey, how are y'all doing this morning?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to tell y'all, I came through St. Vincent's and PSL, Project Save Lives. About Friday will be 60 days for me. And I just want to tell y'all, thank y'all. I appreciate it, everything that you're doing.
You're welcome.
Sure. And tell us a little bit more about your story. What were you dealing with?
Heroin.
How'd you get into it?
I had a start off with opiates, you know, pain pills, and it got to the point to where I couldn't take enough to, you know, to help. And it just got addicted to them, and it just wasn't working. So I had to go to the street, like you said earlier, to get something different. You know, and mm-hmm. once I did that, it just set off a train wreck.
Right. I'm so sorry, you know, but you've gone through the program. You're clean now.
I went through Gateway, went through the detox, went through Gateway, Rico, Joe, Ian, Alexa, all them at the peer specialists through St. Vincent's were awesome. They call me every week. They're good people. And, Doug at Alco, thank you, Doug, for letting me just come up there. You're giving me a safe place to be at.
You're welcome, Mike.
Mike, I really appreciate you calling. I really appreciate you calling, and I know how tough it's been, so thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you very much. And thank you all once again for everything y'all do, because y'all are really touching lives.
Thanks, Michael. Well, there you go. I mean, so he was someone that stayed with you at Alco. Is that right, Doug?
Mike is, I recognize his voice. Mike doesn't stay with us at Alco, but he does hang out there. He's an addict who wants to be in a safe, sober environment. And we have a lot of people that just hang out in our club, our 12-step program clubhouse and our diner. One of the problems, I think, in Jacksonville is we don't have enough detox centers. We're a town of 1 million people, and we have one detox center that has, what, maybe 30 beds?
At Gateway.
Yes. That's an absolute crime.
So, Dr. Caulfield, what about that?
Yes, you know, it's sad to report that Florida is 50th in the nation now for funding for behavioral health care. We advocate, Dr. Palm and I are in Tallahassee probably full-time during session, and others, advocating, educating our legislators, et cetera. I will say that we've had some good results, and we thank the legislature for that. We do have additional monies coming in to fight the opioid epidemic, not only from the state, but from the federal level. But I think Michael is a great example that recovery works, but we do need the resources to be able to treat those that are addicted and need the help.
Brandon has been holding in Lakeshore. Hi, Brandon. How are you? Go ahead.
Hello, good morning. I'd just like to make a brief statement that my mother would be dead from opioid addiction and my father would be dead from alcoholism if not for medical cannabis. We need to stop treating cannabis as a gateway drug and focus on decriminalizing drug addiction and give safe access to drugs that will help addicts to safely withdraw from these deadly, deadly pharmaceuticals.
So, Brandon, they wean themselves off what they were on by using medical marijuana? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And were THC they doing it for pain relief or just to switch to another substance?
THC, which is also the psychoactive compound in cannabis, has also been proven to be a very effective anti-pain medication, because what it does is it basically blocks your ability to perceive pain, and it also reduces inflammation. And this has been proven. And, of course, for decades, this has been denied by both the government and public health.
Okay, Brandon, thanks for the call. This is a touchy subject, I'm sure, for you guys, but I want to ask you about this, Dr. Palm, and the rest of you. There is some data to show that in states where medical marijuana has been legalized, opioid addiction and deaths has declined. Correlation isn't necessarily causation, as we all know, but do you think the growth of medical marijuana will help with this crisis or not?
We have more research to do. Back in the 70s, we used to take people with lung disease and tell them you need to move over to the southwest area of the world, of the country. And then sure enough, southwest area of the country had an increased incidence of lung disease because people moved there. We're doing the research. We just are not there yet.
Doug Jones, what do you think?
Well, I'm not a doctor, so I can't, although I played one on TV years ago,
but really?
I just can't speak to the medical aspect of it. But being in recovery myself, I can just speak on my experience. For me, marijuana was a gateway drug. When marijuana stopped doing what I needed it to do, I went on to something bigger and stronger for it to do for me what I was looking for it to do, and so on and so on, and the cycle just is endless.
Dr. Caulfield.
You know, I've certainly heard some results. I agree with Dr. Palm that more research is necessary. You know, you really have to determine where your drugs, whatever they may be, are coming from. Certainly on the street, we're seeing marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamine now being laced with fentanyl. So that's the deadly ingredient. And we need to be very mindful of anything we ingest. Where is it coming from?
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Susan. We've been talking about people taking opioids to deal with physical pain, but how are we helping people search for safer alternatives to deal with their emotional pain? Because often addiction derives from that.
That's right. And there's a host of resources available for people who are going through emotional and mental anguish. 12-step programs address that beautifully. Mental health programs address that beautifully. And the beautiful thing about Jacksonville is that we have a plethora of 12-step meetings throughout the community. There's about 450 12-step programs a week in Jacksonville. And I know because I've sent my residents to these resources, there's a host of mental health available in Jacksonville as well.
Josh emails the show, the origins of the opiate crisis show yet again that more regulation, not less, is often the answer to these social problems. The free market is impotent when citizens need protection. Dr. Palm, you know, the state finally did crack down on pill mills and got serious about this crisis. But for almost a decade, it was like the Wild West here. There was little to no regulation, and that fueled the crisis, not just in Florida, but all over the country.
During that time, I was a consultant to the boards of pharmacy, medicine, and osteopathic medicine when we were pushing really, really hard for our legislature to finally pass a centralized pharmacy registry. We kept getting resistance and more resistance for the most ridiculous reasons I've heard in my life. We started that fight when there were 5 deaths a day. By the time they finally passed the legislation to create eForce, which is the centralized pharmacy registry, we were having 10 deaths a day. And now again, I realize that it's greed and power, and no matter what the cost. And it's so sad.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the new database released last week by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, that gives everyone a much better look at the true scope of the opioid epidemic. Hundreds of millions of pills were freely prescribed here in Florida for nearly a decade. Pill mills were rampant. They fueled the national crisis as people came here from out of state to get the medications. And as we speak with three addiction specialists right now, LSF Health Systems, Gateway River Region, and the Alco House, we're going to take a few more of your calls. What are your thoughts about all this? It's 549-2937. Curtis is in Orange Park. Hi, Curtis. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Melissa?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I'm three addiction specialists. I think that's great that we have representatives from professional help that can address addiction, because addiction is the problem. Education, addressing personal responsibility, I think, is key. We're in a society where we have access to everything we want, everything we need, and in this case, everything we really don't need. And unfortunately, our system of access makes for problems for people who are susceptible. But I don't know if we can really lay blame to the on the providers, that the medical industry or pharmaceutical industry, as much as we need to focus on the individual. I think in this kind of society, we almost have to have a personal contract of responsibility for how we conduct ourselves. And I don't want to get too far off topic, but I just dropped off two Chinese exchange students who came to live with us for 3 weeks. And they're basically injected into our society and are overstimulated. They get explosion of all that we have to offer here, all of the things that American society offers us. And there's just so much access. I don't know how it would be right to just over-regulate our big companies and our professions in regards to this, just like the cigarette industry. And
Let me ask you, Curtis, just to push back on you a little bit. These drugs were touted in the 90s as safe and not addictive. Some people are biochemically vulnerable to being addicted to drugs, their brain chemistry. Yeah. It's not anything that's in their control. Some people, take a group of 10 people and you all give them opioids, a couple of those people are going to get addicted, just by virtue of their brain chemistry. So is that really their fault?
No. And I agree that if you go back to the 90s, that's going back over 30 years.
Yeah.
Right? But opioids have been around since like the 1500s. They've been around forever.
Right.
In Middle Ages, the opioids have been around. And, we're not strangers to this type of stimulation for our creativity, for our personal anesthesia, like Michael Jackson. This has been around, and it's kind of a walking a tightrope when you were talking about the famous people and how it took the famous people to draw attention to this. The famous people are vulnerable because they're creative and live their lives for their work.
I hear you, Curtis. I just want to get these folks to react to what you're saying. Thank you for all your comments. That's Curtis in Orange Park. Dr. Caulfield.
Yes, I think that it's very important to reduce stigma. I think that there are some individuals that feel that this is a moral or a character issue, that those that become addicted, had a choice and so on. I think we need to really emphasize that addiction is a brain disease. And as you said, Melissa, many people are susceptible due to their brain chemistry. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep that in mind. It's a medical condition that requires treatment.
Manny in Springfield. Go ahead, Manny.
Yeah, I just, you know, I just wanted to comment on how the, you know, Florida was the epicenter of the pill mill epidemic to begin with. And I just find it hard to believe that there's not more resources at the very ground level. Like Doug was talking about earlier, there's only one detox. And we were people were coming from states away to buy pills here. And my story is similar to that. You know, I was on a prescribed medication and then my insurance lapsed. Then I started buying medication on the streets, which is extremely expensive. And so one day, you know, I had a choice until I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
And for me, it takes it. You know, I stay at Alco House. I live at Alco House. For me, it takes a whole army, a whole village around me. I go to Gateway. I do 12 steps. I live at Alco House. I have to be surrounded by an entire village.
To deal with this. And Manny, I'm so glad you're getting that support. And thank you, Manny. That's Manny in Springfield. People like him need an army around them, Doug. And as you've all been pointing out, there just aren't enough resources in this community.
There aren't enough resources in Jacksonville, but what Jacksonville does have as a principal resource is lots of 12-step recovery. And I would encourage anybody that is addicted to reach out. We work with each other. It's we're we programs, and nobody that I know in my experience has been able to conquer addiction
without the help
of another addict.
There is help out there. So contact these specialists, Dr. Raymond Palm. He's with Gateway and River Region, Dr. Christine Caulfield, LSF Health Systems, Doug Jones, Alco House, doing the Lord's work in this town. So thank you all.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank.
Well, he's the creator of an influential mergers and acquisitions firm that started small decades ago, but now is global. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jax Daily Record speaks with Don Wiggins, president of Heritage Capital Group.
Don Wiggins, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Describe what Heritage Capital Group does.
Well, Heritage Capital Group is what's called an investment banking firm, and that term causes a lot of confusion. It sounds like we take deposits and have checking accounts and lend money, and we don't. What the primary focus of Heritage is on helping clients buy and sell companies. We do more than that, but that's the main focus, is companies when it's time to sell, or if they're growing and want to acquire other companies, we help them with that.
How did you determine that Jacksonville needed that service, and you do mergers and acquisitions? How did it evolve?
Interesting question. I was a university professor in a previous life, as you mentioned. I was teaching at Clemson University. I've been coming to Jacksonville for personal reasons since a long time ago. And I could see, or at least I thought I could see, turns out I was right, that Jacksonville was going to be a growth community. And it's a middle market town. And I like working with middle-sized and smaller companies, not big companies. So I could see that. I then took a position at the University of North Florida. And Heritage, what became Heritage, was really part of my consulting practice. Did valuations for companies, got hooked up with the person who owned the predecessor to Heritage, same legal entity, different name. And it evolved that way.
Now, you've built together a real A-list of executives, of principals at the group. I mean, if you look at the names, these are people that know Jacksonville. I mean, you've got Jerry Mallott and Bill Prescott, and you have Mac Hawley, Charlie Tom, Scott McCaleb. They cover the industries in Jacksonville, and they've been here a long time. How did you do that, and why is that a strategy?
Well, it's, as I said, partly luck and partly design, and we do have a broad network. One of the other benefits of getting older is you develop a network in between initially Howard and me. We knew a lot of people, not the same people. So what we've done over the years is look for opportunities with people like the ones you mentioned who are coming out of a first career. They have a lot of runway left, a lot of energy still left. They have a good network. They have a lot of skills. And so we look for that kind of person that has the right background, not necessarily directly in mergers and acquisitions, but certainly in business and maybe in their company they have dealt with, like Charlie Tom was the CEO when Brumos sold. So had a lot of background in mergers and acquisition hands-on. And we look for those people, and over time, you find them.
So what are you and the companies you work with seeing in the economy now, especially in Jacksonville?
Well, it's what are called golden problems. The big problem right now in a lot of situations is getting labor, both white-collar and blue-collar. For example, we have construction clients, and every single one of them will tell you that labor market is extremely tight today. They have trouble getting superintendents and foremen and machine operators. For engineering firms, for example, very difficult to get engineers. We sold an engineering firm up in the North Carolina area several years ago, and one of the major motives for the buyer was, one, to diversify its customer base, but also to get engineers. They had a lot of good engineers on staff, and that was one of the major drivers. So that's what we see, and it's really the thing with business now compared to 20 or 30 years ago, it's always been changing. But Alva Toffler wrote a book years ago, which you're probably familiar with, called Future Shock. And the major point of the book was the faster things go, the faster they go. And if you think now how fast things move with the changing environment, with Amazon for retailers, with the internet and the availability of information, with political changes, tariffs, other political changes, you've got to keep up, and companies that don't keep up are going to get left behind. It's just a major issue for all companies to deal with.
I was going to say, do you have any advice for business owners?
Keep up. If you're, like I said, if you're doing things the way you did them 5 years ago, you're outdated. We just had the landing anniversary for the moon, and one of the things I read, and this is true, we've seen it, is the average smartphone is thousands of times more powerful than the computers that put men on the moon. If you think about that, you know, what power we have with the internet, with communications, with artificial intelligence becoming more and more important. It's difficult and critical to keep up. And if you don't keep up, you're just going to die.
Don Wiggins, president of Heritage Capital Group, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And up next, Culpepper, as Jaguars training camp gets underway. We'll be right back.
Gamble Rogers was a prominent architect, and his son Gamble Rogers was a revered folk musician. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Bruce Horovitz, author of the book Gamble Rogers, A Troubadour's Life. We'll discuss Florida history from the British perspective and talk with state folklorist Amanda Hardiman Griffiths. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The world of lighting is changing fast, with LED technology leading the country into a more energy-efficient future.
Particularly for home and restaurant, the mood that that lighting can create makes a big difference. That means that people will more readily adopt that technology.
Shining a light on lighting technology, next time on Here and Now.
this afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the bizarre world of insects and why we can't live without them. Anne Svardrup Thygesen, professor of conservation biology, tells us why fruit flies are more useful than we think and how cockroaches could be vital to our survival. Her book is called Buzz, Sting, Bite. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The resignation of Puerto Rico's governor is cheered by hundreds of thousands who wanted to see him gone. Now comes the hard part. Who will take over? And can those in power win back the trust of the people? Puerto Rico's rough road ahead, that's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap-Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, Jaguars training camp is underway, and Cole Pepper says he's seeing a little different approach at camp this year. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, the Jaguars put the pads on for the first time in training camp yesterday. Today, they are taking the day off. It's really been a little bit of a easy transition with the weather and some other things. We'll get to that in just a moment. Did want to give you a few of my observations about the Jaguars so far in camp this year. I'm going to caution everybody that this is very early. They've only had four practices, and it's a long way to go. But I think we can draw a couple of conclusions, at least in the early stages. First, everybody wants to know about Nick Foles. How is Nick Foles looking? The quarterback looks like a quarterback. And I know that's simplistic to say, but he's the guy who looks like he's in command of the offense. His leadership has been pointed out by teammates. Defensive players have been talking about how he's putting more stress on them in the passing game. Unsaid, but in sort of inherent in this, is the fact that this is happening in comparison to Blake Bortles. Foles is an upgrade. We know that. We expect that. So far, he has been everything you would want to see out of a guy who you paid a big chunk of change for and who comes in with a good resume. His leadership, his accuracy, the way he's conducted himself, all has been very good on the field. Now we'll see what happens when he starts to get hit and if he can raise the level of play by guys around him. Most notably with the wide receivers. The Jaguars need to see some significant improvements from the wide receivers if they're going to make a step forward this year. And we've seen some good things so far out of D.D. Westbrook and the free agent acquisition Chris Conley, and also DJ Chark. All those guys need to, and if those are your three big players as far as the receiving corps is concerned, that would be a big improvement over what we saw last year when Westbrook was really the only player who was any kind of a threat at all to opposing defenses. We're still waiting, as far as the defense is concerned, the Jaguars defense, for Yannick Ngakoue to show up. His holdout continues. He wants a big long-term deal. The Jaguars want to give him a long-term deal, but the money right now is where the holdup is. And so Ngakoue is not in camp. Doug Marone did say last week that he thinks that it won't take too long before Ngakoue gets into camp. He doesn't think it's going to be an extended holdout, but the two sides certainly have to get together on a long-term deal. He's a young, successful pass rusher, and those are hard to come by in the National Football League. I was talking about how camp has not exactly been grueling so far. The weather has been very comfortable by Jacksonville July standards, and the fact that Doug Marone moved the practices to the morning, so not in the heat of the day. 2 years ago, you might remember, before the 2017 season, Marone had a training camp that was an absolute boot camp. It's not been the case this year. He's backed off even more so than he did last year when he thought he had a veteran team that could handle things, and he had a lot of guys coming back. Well, that didn't go in that direction. I'm actually a little bit surprised that you didn't see Marone go back to a more hardcore camp. At least we haven't so far. But it's not something that Jalen Ramsey and several of the other players we've heard from are all that too upset about.
Yeah, man, it's a big difference. Bodies feel better. Energy's better. Everybody a little bit happier out here. We got some free time and stuff, and we ain't got to be in the building trained all day. We really appreciate them. So we're going to go out there on the field and try to give them all we got.
Jaguars will be back on the field tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. Those are the last times the public can come out to training camp. It's free to attend, but you must register in advance on Jaguars.com.
All right, now to high school football. Cole, it's getting underway today, you say, all around town.
Yeah, as early as this morning, as a matter of fact, 1 minute after midnight, some enterprising schools got things going. Others will be getting going this morning and this evening, this afternoon. Just the start of things as we start looking forward to the Friday night lights, but this is going to be an intriguing year for high school football in the area. You have two schools in our area who are defending state champions, Raines and Mandarin, and you've got a district in A-Day that is absolutely loaded with some of the new schools that have been redistricted, put into a district together with Mandarin and Oakleaf and Fletcher and Bartram Trail. It's going to be an interesting year for high school football.
And last but not least, what a week for swimmers from the First Coast.
Yeah,
right?
Caleb Dressel, a week to remember to be sure at the World Championships in South Korea. He helped the United States to a silver in the 4x100-meter medley relay yesterday. That was his eighth medal of the event, breaking Michael Phelps' record for world championships. Dressel won 6 golds and 2 silvers at the championships. He also broke Phelps' record of the 100-meter butterfly in the semifinals. His golds came in the 50 free, the 100 free, the 50 and 100 fly, the mixed 4x1 free relay, and the 4x1 freestyle relay. Next summer, it's the Olympic trials, and Dressel, the Clay High School alum, looks to be in great form. Right now, he is the best swimmer on planet Earth.
All right. Wow. Well, thanks, Cole. Always good to have you on the show. Catch Cole every night on Channel 4, our news partner. Follow him on Twitter, @ColePepper, and catch him every Monday on this show. And that is our show today. Our producer is the scintillating Heather Schatz. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum directs this show every single morning. And we always value your feedback, too. So send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, the renewed abortion debate as activists speak out here on the First Coast. We'll take a closer look tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for being with us. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.